Greetings, and welcome to a first for the World Wide Web, the Internet's only all-audio vodcast.
For the purposes of decency, the video has been removed.
I'm Count Vargelon.
I'm Dive Mistress.
Okay, so I just got finished watching Michael Clayton for the third time.
Third time?
Yes, the third time. It is a wonderful movie. You have not seen Michael Clayton.
No, I have not. I meant to, but I didn't.
Okay. Well, you've got to see Michael Clayton.
I had to do a lot of things.
And in fact, everyone out there in internet land has to see Michael Clayton for one simple rule. It is now the baseline by which all other films need to be judged. Michael Clayton.
What? Why?
Okay.
Of all the gazillions of movies out there that you've seen.
Okay.
Why Michael Clayton?
Try to explain this as clearly as possible. Now, Michael Clayton is by no means the best movie ever made. Wasn't the best movie of that year.
What is the best movie ever made?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Really?
It's the best movie bar none ever made.
Really?
Nothing else even comes close.
Really?
Really. It's not my favorite movie. But it's the best movie ever made.
Okay.
It is in the top five. I mean, it's Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Statement.
You can't show me a film that's made better than Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I might.
You can try. Anyhow, Michael Clayton, right? What it has, everyone last year acted like it was such a great film. You know, they gave nominated for Academy Awards, made a big deal out of it. And it's a good film. It's a very good film. But it's not, you know, a special blow-your-mind kind of movie. It's a movie where there's nothing wrong with the film. You know, it makes no mistakes. The plot is airtight. All the characters' motivations make sense. Like, it is an exercise in the perfectly executed plot.
Okay.
Like, there's nothing wrong with the movie. And so I want to use it as the baseline, where I want to show it to people and say, look, if your script isn't as good as this, don't bother making it. As simple as that.
But is it an interesting story?
It is an interesting story.
Okay.
It's the story about
some guy named Michael Clayton.
Some guy named, well, he's a lawyer. You know, he's a lawyer, and he's the guy who, when rich people get into drunk driving accidents, you know how they call a lawyer to come and get them out of trouble? That's who he is.
Oh, okay.
It's an interesting story about that. And the premise is that another lawyer on a big case who he is friends with has gone nuts because he's manic depressive, and Michael Clayton is called in to calm things down. And, of course, because it's a film, he fails to do that. Because if he had succeeded...
I just gave away the end. No one needs to see it anymore.
I've given away the first 10 minutes. If he had succeeded in calming it down, where would the film be? My point is, like, do you remember how Gene Hackman used to make, like, a lot of movies in the 90s?
Like, sure.
Did you see Narrow Margin?
No.
The Package?
No.
Him and Tommy Lee Jones. Did you just giggle from that? Oh, my God. The Package. Narrow Margin. That was the Mary Elizabeth Master Antonio, the court film.
I don't know.
You got to get out of horror for like 5 minutes.
I do get out of horror for 5 minutes, and I watch real movies. I just don't watch those real movies.
Okay. What I'm saying is, he used to make a lot of just these solid thrillers.
Right.
Like, they didn't have, the plots weren't especially ambitious, they weren't trying to do much, but what they did do, they executed flawlessly. And this is the perfect example of that kind of movie. I could totally see it having been a Gene Hackman movie had it been made 15 years ago, when there used to be a lot of movies like this. I think the reason Michael Clayton looks so good is because films on the whole have gotten so terrible.
Right.
That, you know, something like Michael Clayton just has to look good in comparison. When really it's just the baseline for how good a film should have to be to get made.
But, like, a film being good.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of subjective. I mean, you yourself have said.
Okay.
That you can love a film unconditionally. It can be the worst piece of trash ever committed to celluloid.
There are a number of films.
And you can still love it. I, myself, a big fan of a couple. I'm not going to bother to name them. No one needs to know. But I think they're great movies.
Okay, there
they aren't.
A number of films that I love unconditionally as well. But I think that it's a mistake to separate what you love unconditionally from what are actually good movies. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about personal fondness. I'm saying quantifiable quality in film.
But there are also movies that are made, and the script holds together,
yeah,
and it's competently produced, But it's still just a shit film.
I'd like an example of that, please.
Well, nothing's coming to mind. I just thought, like, you would keep talking and I could think about it.
Oh, okay. So you wanted me to cover the fact that you could not back up your point even a little.
Yes.
That is a daring rhetorical argument.
Well, you know.
I am going to keep talking. Awesome. You take a second to think about something. My point is that if a film is perfectly executed, it has a much better chance of being an enjoyable experience than a film that's roughly executed. And yes, do I like my share of genre films? Am I one of the world's leading experts on the Friday the 13th film? That's right. I'm both a Jasonographer and a Jasonologist.
Oh.
I know. Yeah. Not a lot of people can boast of both those degrees. But I can love them without saying they're well-executed films. Like, some of them are better executed than others. But every one of them, and I'm, this is going to sound a little crazy, I admit, that had the chance to be a great film had it been written better and executed better. And it sounds like I'm basically saying, well, had it been a better movie, it would have been better. But what I'm saying, which is true. But what I'm saying is, any film, like whatever premise you have, and I separate premise completely from execution, what the idea is, what the movie is about. I think any premise for a movie, well, almost any premise for a movie, there's places you should never go, but almost any premise from a movie can be a great film and a film worth watching if it's really well written and really well executed. Like, just because a film is a genre film doesn't mean it has to be dismissed completely. That being said, I think a lot of the films we love as genre film lovers, we are forced to love unconditionally because genre is so disrespected.
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
Like, Event Horizon, for example.
I hate Event Horizon.
See?
There you go.
As do I. I don't feel any societal pressure to love that movie because it happens to be a genre film.
No, no. Okay, not exactly my point.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space
is a wonderful film.
Is not a wonderful film.
What a wonderful
by
film.
By any stretch of the imagination.
No, it's not. Yeah, but he did the shadow puppet of Washington crossing the Delaware. And you know what? That frigging sold me, okay? And then the shadow puppet turned into Tyrannosaur and ate people, and that was less interesting. But, you know, come on, how much would it be if George Washington had attacked those people? But why do dinosaurs? No, but the point I was making was, like, because there is less of an audience, or at least a perceived audience, probably an audience for genre fiction, and less money going into it, there's this idea that as long as you get the things that genre fans want to see into a film, you don't have to work harder. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And here's the far more controversial thing. Because so many of the classics in the genre were low-budget films done by fans who just went out there, it gives genre fans who are not smart people and do not have any talent...
It gives them license to go to make their own.
That's what I'm saying. Which are all distributed by Lionsgate.
Ouch!
Lionsgate will distribute anything that is 90 minutes long and has both breasts and gore. It is true.
And see, this is a perfect platform from which to launch Naked and Violent.
Yes, Naked and Violent is a film we've been working on for some time.
That's true. Yep.
Going on a decade now.
No new developments so far.
No, we don't actually have a script yet, but it's going to change the world.
We've got some good characters, though. We have
some good solid characters who I think are ready to change the world.
The face of horror cinema.
Yes, will be changed by a little something called Naked and Violent. But which brings me roughly to our next subject, which is a film that I feel does not pass the Michael Clayton test for film quality.
Okay.
And that film is The Dark Knight.
I don't even know where to start.
Well, start somewhere, please.
I disagree. I loved it.
You do? Do you disagree vociferously?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it.
Did you love it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Okay, so she loved it. I have a question. I'm going to pose you a couple. Okay, I'm going to say something. Like 5 minutes into the film, I was as happy as a person can conceivably be watching a movie. And I'll tell you why. There's a bunch of guys, they're going to be dealing drugs in a parking garage. And then the van opens up and the drug dealer is Scarecrow.
That was awesome.
And you know what? I was happy. Yeah. And he said, what did he say? He's like, I promised your users an experience. I just didn't say it would be a pleasant one. Or something like that. And I'm like, yeah, you've got me. That's... You had another bat villain randomly show up for no reason.
That's awesome.
Who's not going to be in the rest of the movie.
He changed his eye color.
I loved that.
Did you notice moment. That?
I did not notice that. Yeah. I have, for the record, spent very little time staring into Cillian Murphy's eyes.
Well, you should spend a little more because they're lovely.
What did his eyes used to be?
Well, in Batman Begins, he's got blue eyes. Blue eyes.
Okay. And in this
one? And this one he had brown eyes.
So did they just not make him wear contacts this time?
Aww.
Or was he wearing contacts this time?
Aww.
As a stalker of Cillian Murphy, I thought you would have checked.
I am not a stalker. I've seen him in exactly two movies.
Okay. Two? Oh, right. He was 28 Days Later. Right.
He's in 28 Days Later?
He's the guy in 28 Days Later.
Oh, shit. Okay. Three movies.
What was the third movie?
Batman Begins, Dark Knight.
Oh, and I don't count his cameo in Dark Knight.
It's a movie. He's in it.
All right. Fine. Okay. Sure. You got me. Anyway, what I'm saying is the film had a great opening, right? And from there, I felt it was all downhill. She's so stunned she doesn't know how to respond.
I don't know what to say to that.
Okay, here's some things that I found questionable about the film. So, moment one, actually, and that wasn't even the opening. There was already disappointment in the opening.
The opening was awesome!
Okay, but my question is, if you're trying to sneak into a bank and raid it quickly, why wouldn't you send glass showering down onto the street below where it could have injured someone and had them call the police on the crazy clowns who were sliding into the thing? Because their entire plan was based on the fact that the bank would not call the police, it would only call the rest of the mob.
Yeah.
So why smash a great big window in public, which could lead someone to call the police, which would screw up the Joker's entire plan?
Because everyone knows that bank's owned by the mob.
Yeah, but a guy walking down the street who has a shower of glass land on his head, then when he's lying on the ground bleeding, looking up and seeing clowns going down a rappelling line to the next building, doesn't know about a bank. He's just going to phone the cops and say, clowns attacked me with broken glass.
Yeah, but that didn't happen. Clowns didn't attack him with broken glass.
But what I'm saying is their plan depended on there being no one walking down that public street in the middle of a business day.
Yeah, and it worked.
Okay. All right.
It was a well thought out and executed plan. Okay. I don't see what the problem is.
I think the problem that their plan required random chance to work kind of hurt it. Oh, but I did love seeing William Fichtner.
Yes, that was very, yeah, that was a nice surprise.
It's nice having him show up and not get killed off. Barely, almost got killed off. That close to getting killed off.
Close call.
We could see him again. I don't know why we would. And you know who else was in the movie? Spawn.
He was? Who was he?
He was the black gangster who the Joker killed.
Oh, shit, you're right.
That was Spawn.
Right on. Way to go, Spawn.
Anyway.
Also, yes. In Exit Wounds.
He was the bad guy in Exit Wounds, yeah. Yes. The notable for being the first person that Steven Seagal has ever had a kung fu fight with on film.
Really?
You go and you watch every single Steven Seagal movie up until that point, and it is just Steven Seagal beating people up and humiliating them.
That's not true. He has a knife fight with Tommy Lee Jones.
Not a full-on kung fu fight. Just the two of them going with knives for like 45 seconds, and then he stabs Tommy Lee Jones in the head.
I'm sure he does kung fu somebody. I think about this. I've seen a lot of Steven Seagal movies.
And I'm not saying that it's entirely
embarrassing to admit.
It is. I'm not saying it's entirely Steven Seagal's ridiculous ego on display, but I think it's
nice.
A statement about his character that he will never let, well, his character, it's a statement about his personality that he will never let his character have to actually struggle to fight someone. Like, he'll have to travel across the
good.
World. That's my point. Like any other action hero, in order to build up his triumph, will have a villain who's really good and he has to struggle to beat him. Whereas Steven Seagal's character is so good that the only thing that is ever in his way is that he is geographically not within 4 feet of the enemy.
I'm going to have to think some more about this one.
So you think of Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon. When he fights the guy with the tiger claw hand, you know, it's not a guarantee that he's going to win. Whereas whenever Steven Seagal gets within 5 feet of the bad guy, it's like just, oh, well, now he's dead. And do you remember how the entire film Out for Justice builds up to basically him emasculating and humiliating William Forsythe? Like, William Forsythe runs around the town just randomly murdering people. And, like, he's this giant badass. And then literally his fight with Steven Seagal is him being humiliated.
Yeah, and then shot.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. And I do.
And William Sadler in Hard to Kill is the same thing.
Have you seen her? I got confused about what I've seen and what I haven't seen. Hard to Kill.
Also known as Seven-Year Storm, where Mason Storm is put into a coma for 7 years. And then Kelly LeBrock is so enamored by the size of his penis that she prays he will wake up so they can, you know, get it on.
How does she have the biggest penises?
She's his nurse.
Oh, okay.
It's a terrible movie.
I haven't seen it. But again, now you ruined it for me.
I have ruined that important plot point. Just for the record, he was woken up by the power of a kitten.
Kittens are powerful creatures,
Kittens have powers. I cannot deny this. But anyway, I'm getting really far from my point, which was I hated Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
You know, if you would read Castle of Argelon, you would know that. I can't believe this is surprising to you.
Oh, my God. I don't even know you. I loved it. I am completely in love with it.
Give me an example of something you liked about that performance.
I'm going to go with everything. I liked everything about it. He was amazing.
Okay. My issue, and I can't be the only person out there who feels this.
You're too much of a geek.
I might be too much of a geek. Is I feel it was less of a performance and more of a... How shall I put this? It was less of a performance and more of a funny walk and a funny voice.
First of all, he walked once. One time did he walk funny.
No. What I'm saying, I'm not saying talking about the clown walk he did at that one point in the film. What I'm saying is he spent a month working on the character's voice and working on how the character had moved. But what I'm saying is the character had no internal life past... like, walking in a strange way and talking in a strange way. Like,
I loved it.
I think the costumer did all the work, and I think the writing did all the work. I don't think his performance had any life to it.
I disagree. I think the whole thing came together. I thought he was outstanding.
I'm just saying...
outstanding! I watched the entire movie with my mouth hanging open.
To be fair, and I mean, I'll give this as something that people can use to discredit me, I prefer Brian Cox's Hannibal Lecter... to Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter.
Really?
Because Brian Cox's Hannibal Lecter seems like he's a real person, whereas Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter is an alien thing. And a lot of people prefer that about Anthony Hopkins, but I find the cartoonishness of that less scary than if there's something there that you can understand came from somewhere, and now he's a monster.
I don't know. I thought that this Joker was, he was like a real threat to the people around him.
Okay.
And also, well aware of who and what he was.
Yeah.
And he has this, he's got no past, no history, and no real name.
All true. I'm not going to argue with that. Mm. But that being said, the thing, and I'm going to go back to Brian Cox on this one, the thing about Brian Cox's Hannibal Lecter is he seemed like a guy who actually could have been your therapist. Who actually could have been a doctor who's just some doctor at the hospital you went to who works as a therapist there, as a psychiatrist, and you go to see him, and then you read that he's been cannibalizing people for 10 years, and it's the freakiest thing in the world. And then you start to realize, God, maybe he was creepy. In the same way, the idea of the Joker is, and again, I'm a comic book nerd, sue me, is that for all appearances, he's a guy in clown makeup who's in a good mood. So then when he turns around and starts murdering people, there's a disconnect there that's scary to people. By comparison, Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter, no one would ever go to see him as a therapist. Like, did you see, tell me you saw Red Dragon.
I did not.
You did not see Red Dragon. In Red Dragon, the terrible film Red Dragon. See, Manhunter is the Brian Cox one.
Yeah, I know. But that was like a long time ago when I saw it. I barely remember Brian Cox.
Okay. Well, if you watch it again, you'll see what I'm talking about. But anyway, in Manhunter, right? In Red Dragon, we flash back to Hannibal Lecter as a psychiatrist.
And you're like, see, I can't comment because I never saw it.
Okay. Well, after you've seen it, do some research. That's right. I'm telling you to go do research.
I don't have enough research to do. I got to do yours, too.
No, this one's yours. there's a scene with him where he's still a psychologist. Yeah, sorry. Where he's still a psychiatrist. And you don't believe for a second that anyone would go and see this guy because he's so intensely creepy. You know, Anthony Hopkins can't turn off the voice and the walk and the looks. And, like, you just don't believe for a second that anyone would ever sit down and talk to this guy. Like,
well, maybe that's a problem with the way Anthony Hopkins, like, no, Anthony but Hopkins.
I know. That's my point. That's my point exactly. Like, the Hannibal Lecter, who's this creepy monster, might be interesting, but he's so much less real and intimate and scary to me than a guy who you might actually know who's just this crazy guy. In the same way, Heath Ledger's Joker...
But the Joker is a crazy guy. He's a fucking clown.
Yes.
He's got scars all over his face.
Well, that's my point. By giving him scars, by giving him ridiculous makeup, by making it look like he smells terrible. Like, that guy smells awful.
I didn't get
from
that.
Looking at.
I didn't.
Did you see his hair? Did you see his clothes?
He just had a bad dye job. His clothes are clean.
Anyway,
tailor made.
Yes, they were tailor made.
I didn't.
With the mob's money.
that makes him stinky.
I'm just saying he looked filthy. My point is that there's no other level to it beyond the here's a guy with scars and, you know, messy hair and a creepy suit.
But but his character in this film, he's just such a complete psychopath that we can't connect with him on any level whatsoever.
But my point is,
because he's so beyond our understanding.
And I feel that.
He is completely inhuman.
I feel that hurts the film in the same way. You can say that.
I didn't think so at all.
You can say that same thing. You can say the exact same thing about Jason, that he's more of a thing, a force of nature, an evil creature than an actual character, because that's completely true. That doesn't make it a good thing. That doesn't make it a good character. It doesn't make it a good performance. I think he's less of a character. I think the fact that the character has no internal life beyond the voice and beyond the hair, like the Joker throughout his history, right? His subtext has always been that he basically wanted to make the whole world irrational and crazy and random as he sees it, right? That's the subtext. From moment to moment, whatever kind of schemes he's had, he's also always had a specific thing he was trying to accomplish. They got rid of, like, the specific thing he was trying to accomplish.
Joker doesn't have a goal he's trying to accomplish.
That's my point.
He even came out, he, like, explains all of that for you.
This is my point. Thank you. That's my point. This character doesn't even want anything.
Again, I think we're just, where you find fault, I see strength.
The character doesn't even want anything. They've taken the Joker's subtext and not only making it the character's, made the subtext his motive, they actually have the character come out and announce, this is my subtext. Like, it's like a Lars von Trier movie suddenly. You know, it's like, screw subtext, screw, you know, subtlety. Let's just have the characters announcing what their subtext are.
I had no problem with it. I really liked it. And okay. I've read exactly one Batman comic.
Which one was that?
Arkham Asylum.
Oh, that's terrible. Never read Arkham Asylum. God, it's Grant Morrison. Just flee. People, anyone listening who has not read Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum, never do it, no matter how big a fan you are of Dave McKean's art.
God.
It is Dave McKean, right?
I don't know.
She doesn't like comic books, people.
It's not that I don't like comic books. I'm just not a comic book geek like some people.
Okay. I think the point that I've been making most clear, and tell me how you react to this, is that, how do I put this? The scene where he's trying to get people to blow each other up on the boats.
Yeah. Okay? That's a good scene.
Fine scene. No problem scene. Hey, Tiny Lister, Zeus the Human Wrecking Machine showed up in it. That was pretty cool. Zeus the Human Wrecking Machine. Right. when Batman tackles the Joker and knocks him down and says, look, you know, they're not blowing each other up. You've lost. It doesn't affect the Joker at all.
Because he's going to blow them up.
No, I totally understand that he would blow them up. What I'm saying is his entire character is based around showing civilized society that everyone's as awful as he is. They just need to be put in the right circumstance. This was the central theme of The Killing Joke, which part of the character's interpretation is based on. Alan Moore's The Killing Joke, where he was trying to prove the point that anyone can be turned into someone like him. You just have to have something bad enough happen to you, and your mind will disconnect and you'll go crazy. Mm-hmm. And in that, he is proven wrong, and it hurts him. And he feels like he has been destroyed just for a second because his entire worldview has been called into question.
Are you talking about The Killing Joke?
I'm talking about The Killing Joke.
Okay.
Just for a second. That's all it is. There's this moment where his point of view has been defeated and he's angry and he's hurt and he's pissed off. And it's one panel of him just being, you know, no character, no show. Everything he believes in has just been questioned, and it's earth-shattering to him. And then he goes back to being the Joker. And then he tries to fight Batman, goes back to being the Joker, doing the things. And I'm saying, this character didn't have that moment. Like, he never...
I think maybe what your problem is that you've read a lot of Batman.
I have read a lot of Batman.
You know, kind of grew up with Batman.
I have.
And you sort of pick and choose the Jokers that you like from all the series. And you have your favorite... And this Joker wasn't it. And so you're finding fault.
Okay. I totally see what you're saying.
I think you might be taking it too personally.
You do have that point, but my point...
I come from a place where I don't know... The only Batman I know is what I watch on TV.
That's true.
Okay? And I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
And like that Joker, he's psychotic and, you know... He's creepy. He's a job and what have you. And yeah, and creepy and all the rest of it. Mark Hamill's a wonderful job voicing him. Anyway... You know, that this is a completely different Joker from that Joker, but I don't see a problem with that.
Okay. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. It is a completely different Joker, right? You're absolutely right, but my point is, to give him that moment of defeat, to give him that moment lets you into the window of having the character actually care about something. Like, it never seems to, because he doesn't feel defeated when he loses, because he doesn't feel actually hurt, it feels like the character didn't really care that much about whether he succeeded or not.
Because, well, the thing at his point, because he's got the backup detonator.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of whether or not these people try and kill themselves. He's going to do it for them, and he's going to do it anyway.
I see that, but I'm saying that for the character to really mean something, for the character really to have, like I said, the inner life, the other level, he has to desperately want to prove to Batman something. That for all this, all Batman's doing trying to save them, looking for the good in people, asking them to stand up, the Joker is the opposite. He's trying to show Batman that everyone's just as corrupt and dirty and looking out for themselves first as he is.
But then if he were to feel defeat, even for just a second, it would still bring him down to a level on which we could understand. That would make him human again. And his character is so inhuman. So,
and that's why I didn't find it interesting.
But that's what I love. But I always love the bad guy anyway.
But I'm saying he'd be a more interesting bad guy if he had that moment.
I don't think so. I think because he's so alien and so unknowable.
He's just Jason.
But he talks.
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
He's a walking, talking Jason.
I know, you know? But I'm just saying that I don't think that's a great character, and I don't think that's a great performance without that other level.
I completely disagree with you on every point. I thought he was amazing.
Okay. But here's one thing.
I want to see it again.
Okay. Here's one thing you can't disagree on. Okay. I'm going to bet you that you cannot disagree on this one.
All right.
It was a crucial error to try and squeeze all of the Harvey Dent stuff into this film.
It did seem like an awful lot.
Yeah. Like, there's 90 minutes of a Joker movie, and then they tried to cram, like...
20 minutes of Two-Face.
Yeah, like a whole Two-Face movie into just 20 minutes.
Yeah, that was a bit odd.
To the point where there's, like, huge editing problems in the second half of that film.
Well, I thought, like, they introduced Harvey Dent, and then it's like, okay, well, movie number 3 will be Two-Face.
Yes.
But... No.
No, they killed him off. Right. Well, what really got me was, like, the weird editing problems.
But like for what you went back, Joker trying to say that, you know, everyone just needs to be pushed so far and they'll become like he is.
Yeah. That would have had more resonance had it been stretched into the third film. Like, okay, imagine this. Imagine this is the structure. You do the whole film the same way. Batman's girlfriend gets blown up. Harvey Dent gets injured. All of that stuff, right? And then you end the movie. You know, he's just taken down the Joker, did that whole thing, stopped the fairy thing, beat up the Joker, you know. And the Joker makes the point that you may have beaten me, but the point is I've destroyed Harvey Dent. Then you cut back to Harvey Dent, you know, alone in the hospital, you know, freaked out with the eye and realize, oh, God, he's right. The Joker really has done something awful, and you take that into the third movie. How is that not more interesting than trying to resolve the entirety of the Two-Face character? No,
I
agree with,
like, that would have been, that's cool. And I did think, like, I felt that it, when we switched over to Two-Face, I'm like, oh, now I'm watching a different movie.
Yeah. And the problem is, and I think that is the real problem, is you've ruined, you've lost the Two-Face character, where you can't really do multiple movies about the Joker. But you can do as much story as you want about Two-Face. Like, Two-Face is the character that has depth. Two-Face is the character that has legs. Joker is a gimmick. They really should have killed Joker off.
But they can't. But they also address that in the movie that they can't.
Why can't they exactly?
I don't remember. But it's something about, you know, like, it's that the Harry Potter Voldemort thing, you know?
You know, but the point is...
No, they need each other. That's what it was.
They don't. But the point is, they don't need each other.
And not from your fanboy point of view.
Fanboy or not, my point is, like, you look at this, right? For the love of God, Michael Caine gives a speech in the movie, a whole long speech in the movie, the only point of which is, you should probably kill the Joker. That was the only point of that speech. He goes on for 5 minutes when he could have just said, seriously, Christian Bale, just kill the Joker. And, like, the thing about Two-Face as a character is he's the one who has legs as a character because he's someone Batman knew. He's someone Batman, you know, cares about and wants to help. And the idea of Two-Face's redemption is the same as fixing Gotham. Whereas the Joker is just a guy who shows up every 6 months and kills a bunch of people.
Well, he's like the antithesis of Batman. You can look at him like that.
Yes, but my point is, every time you have the Joker kill someone...
Whereas Batman is troubled and conflicted and has depth.
Yeah. You're right. Joker is a two-dimensional, you know, dull kind of thing.
Well, that's not what I meant. Well, you're just twisting my words.
I am, but I'm twisting them expertly.
No. Pushing them like a jerk.
But the point I'm making is, like, every time you have the Joker kill someone, and this is all in reference to an article I'm writing, yes, but every time you have the Joker kill someone, you make Batman look like an idiot for not killing him.
No, I don't think so.
Really? Like, Batman has had ample opportunity to kill the Joker, and not, I don't want to beat this too far, but he did kill Liam Neeson in the first movie.
He just didn't save him. He made a point saying, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you.
That's true. So why did he save the Joker?
Because he can't kill the Joker.
But he didn't have to save him.
No, but like that's a different thing, though. It has nothing to do with him being able to commit homicide.
How is that a different thing?
Because Joker says, I think he says, you can't kill me because you need me. They need each other.
But I don't understand how you think Batman needs the Joker. Like, I understand how, from a filmmaker's standpoint, they feel they need to keep the Joker around for marketing reasons. But I'm just saying, psychologically, in what way does Batman need the Joker?
I don't know. That's something the Joker said in the movie. I don't remember. I saw it months ago.
Okay. I saw it a month ago. It only came out in July.
Time passes differently when you live in the UK.
Okay. Okay, you got me there. I guess that's how time works. No, but my point is, every time the Joker kills someone, it's kind of Batman's fault for not having just killed the Joker. And there's no reason to not... Like, I'm just saying that from a character standpoint, there's no reason for Batman to not kill the Joker. It's as simple as that. Like, there's just no reason not to.
Well, explain to me then why he never kills a Joker in any of the comics.
Because of the Comics Code Authority.
What?
Batman killed people right up until the 50s. And then in 1954, Congress said, you can't have people killing people in comics anymore. And so they were legally mandated to have heroes not kill people anymore. So they made up all this crap about having codes against killing people.
Given the comic I just gave you, there's killing all over the place.
Because by the 90s, all that stuff had gone away. Because they had written, in most comics, it didn't matter. Because, you know, Wolverine always clawed people to death. That's what Wolverine did. He was created in the 70s when the Comics Code Authority was starting to go out. But because they had rewritten the code against killing into the origins of Batman and Superman, so many of the stories revolved around those codes, they didn't want to change them. It's completely true. Captain Marvel killed people.
Such a geek.
Captain Marvel. No, Captain Marvel, who is a children's character, who has always been a character for children, even he killed people back in the 30s and the 40s, okay? All characters. In fact, I'm going to challenge you and everyone out there in internet land to find me a non-comic book related character who has a code against killing and keeps up with it. And that's created before 1930, obviously. There have been ones since. Well, there have been ones since that have been affected by this cultural thing with Batman's code and their versions of Batman and blah, 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 blah. So obviously before the creation of Batman, any fictional character with a code against killing. I don't think there is one. Can you come up with anything?
You know I can't.
I do know you can't. Oh, and also disqualified are Chinese Buddhist martial art heroes. Because that's a religious thing, and that's not what we're talking about. Okay? So that is the challenge to you, our viewers. Find me a character invented before Batman who's right. not comic book related, who had a code against killing people, and didn't kill people. I bet there isn't one.
I'm sure there is.
Everybody in the Bible killed people. And Jesus is not a superhero.
I have no idea what you're even talking about anymore.
Robin Hood kills people. Scarlet Pimpernel kills people. Zorro kills people. Like, everybody kills people.
I'm trying to think. I went to this...
Oh, no, and you have to be in a position to kill someone, obviously. I mean, if Sherlock Holmes never got in a gunfight, you know, that's not an issue. He has to have stated a code against killing people, been an opportunity where he could have solved a situation by killing someone, and elected not to. That's the challenge.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, as a comic book fan, I can say, you know what the most retarded plan about this code against killing people thing is? What? It's like, seriously, if you buy 5 Batman comics, right, just any 5 random Batman comics, there will be a scene in one of them where Batman kicks a guy in the neck down a flight of stairs. I'm like, I don't care how good a martial artist you are, there's no way you can confirm that that guy's not dead now. In fact, he's probably dead. You know, there's just no way.
I don't kick a lot of people in the neck down flights of stairs.
But just your basic understanding of human physiology, wouldn't you say that would be likely a fatal injury?
I suppose it depends how hard you kick them and how many stairs they fell
down. I'll give you that one. I can't argue with that. I will totally give you that one. What was the other thing I was going to... oh, yes, the other thing I wanted to say, and this is going to be a bit of an off thing, but Dark Knight.
Oh, Christ.
So, just from a standpoint, you're driving a police convoy, right, down the street, and you find that someone has driven a fire truck and ironically lit it on fire across the lane you're supposed to be driving in. Do you, A... drive down to the underpass where it's much easier to attack you, right? Okay, that's A. Or do you just go into the lane of oncoming traffic that is completely empty until you can merge back?
I'm going to go with A.
Really?
Yes.
So it'll be much easier to attack you?
Yes.
And yes, for the record, I know they were trying to get the Joker to attack them. But had they not played so clearly into the Joker's schemes, you know, they would have lost a lot fewer cops' lives in catching the Joker. Or here's another good way to catch the Joker. When you see that one of the when you're looking to catch a character named the Joker, who's clown-themed, right? And you see that one of the trailers you've stopped, so you can clear the way for the police convoy, has a giant picture of a circus on the side with the word laughter, but then someone has drawn a giant S next to the laughter to create the word slaughter. You might want to search that truck a little more carefully.
They could have been like You don't know what was going on off screen.
Except we actually see the guy, the cop, standing next to that truck saying, you're going to have to hold on for a second. And then the guy driving the truck shoots him. Mm-hmm. I'm like, why didn't the cop radio for backup when he saw that it was an evil clown themed truck?
He's going to get shot anyway. Wouldn't have made a difference.
I'm just saying, had the cops been written to be a slightly less morons, I would have found it more plausible.
You're finding fault to fault because you didn't like the movie.
To be fair, there are flaws there to be found.
Nitpicking.
Okay, you win. I am nitpicking. I agree. Okay. Thank you very much. All right. So I think we're going to be wrapping up this version of the All Audio Vodcast. But first, we'd like to close again with thanking you for listening and watching.
Yes, thank you.
And we will see you next time here on the Vodcast. As always, we can be reached at vargilon@gmail.com. This is Count Vargilon signing off.
Dive Mistress wishing you a good evening.